This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a new book, Tom Brokaw writes that the presidential campaign of 2008 promises to be a showdown between political forces unleashed 40 years ago in the 1960s. That's a period Brokaw describes as the time between the assassination of John Kennedy in 1963 and the resignation of Richard Nixon in 1974. And the pivotal year, he writes, was 1968, which saw the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, an expanding war in Vietnam and expanding protests, riots outside the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the election of Republican Richard Nixon to the presidency, and a space shot that sent men around the moon. How did 1968 change you and the country? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later this hour, poet Seamus Heaney joins us to talk about and to read from his translation of Beowulf. But first, Tom Brokaw, who covered many of the critical events and movements of the 1960s for NBC News. Later, of course, he anchored the NBC Nightly News for more than 20 years. His new book is called Boom, Voices of the 60s, and the author joins us here in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
Let me begin by asking you about a quote that seems to lie at the heart of your book from the historian Alan Brinkley. Of course, he's the son of your former colleague, David Brinkley. And he says the 1960s were not so much a revolution as a counter-revolution.
He does, and I think that all the evidence, objective and empirical, backs him up. Lots of people would beat their breasts and say we changed the world in the 1960s, left of center. And Alan would point out to them that between Governor Wallace and Richard Nixon that year, they got 60% of the vote. There was a real silent majority. As Pat Buchanan points out in the book, we won 6 of the 8 next elections, we being the Republican Party and the conservative side of the spectrum this time. That's who he's referring to. There was a real pushback against what was going on in the streets and in the culture and in the theatrics of the time. And Alan feels very strongly, he's now a provost at Columbia University, that there has been a misreading of what happened in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. That, in fact, the recoil from what people saw on their television streets in the streets of Chicago, and also within the civil rights movement, to be fair, that those two things drove most Americans to the other side.
Well, I think more in the latter half of the civil rights movement. I think it was the move to black power and the more militant approaches. I think Dr. King had this country moving in a moral and passionate wave in the early part of the 1960s. I suppose it's summarized in our own family, in my own family. I went home from Chicago and stopped in Yankton, South Dakota. My parents were Blue Ribbon Charter members of the FDR coalition. They had grown up in the Depression and gone through difficult times. He was a demigod in our family. And I came home, you know, filled with the fervor of Chicago as a young reporter had been on the streets. And my father was in an outrage. They'd been burning the American flag. They'd been carrying the Viet Cong flag. He saw them as mostly privileged elites. My brother was in Vietnam as a Marine. These were people who had student deferments, after all. They were using the kind of language they were using against the police. And he was not sympathetic at all, even though he hated the war. And it was, the next morning when I woke up after this murderous argument that we'd had, fueled by far too much drinking on my part, I woke up with a terrible hangover and a realization that the Democratic Party was going to be in real trouble, because I thought that my father represented the core values of the old FDR establishment, which began to unravel after that summer.
Yet even after the disaster, political disaster of Watergate, which of course removed Richard Nixon from power, the Republican Party, as you suggest, the Democrats won one presidential election after that, and the Republicans have basically formed the majorities ever since.
Because the internecine warfare within the Democratic Party did not stop. They were always at war with each other over what was the truest calling of the Democratic Party. The Republicans always had the ability to kind of put the past behind them very quickly, keep their think tanks up and running, organize or get out the vote drives, and say to the country, this is who we are, and this is who we think you want us to be, and follow us.
Interesting interview with Jim Webb, the, of course, Secretary of the Navy and, under President Reagan, and then later, of course, became a Democrat. He was, before that, one of the most honored Marines to serve in Vietnam. And you cite him in one incident at making a speech at a Confederate memorial where he said he believes that divisions at home that allowed elites to avoid service are destructive and consequential to this day.
He took with him to that Confederate memorial, by the way, one of his very best friends who was a black Marine. He took him there because he said, we identify with each other. We, the working class, he comes from Appalachian roots. He does feel very strongly that we have allowed this country to be divided between those who go to harm's way on behalf of all of us and those who have nothing asked of them. No sacrifices are being made by the civilian population in this war, the civilian population that does not have a child or a sister or a mother or a father or a brother in uniform and fighting. He wants very much to have some idea for succeeding generations of public service, not necessarily in uniform, but he thinks that we ought to find a way that everyone gives back at some point.
And you do sort of a double interview with him and Jim Fallows, of course, the famous reporter who's been on this program many times, who did not serve, chose to avoid service.
And wrote, I thought, really one of the most important pieces of the post-1960s period, which is when he just, what did you do in the class war, Daddy, it was called. It was in the Washington Monthly. And it was about that day when he was at Harvard and he had starved himself a lot and contrived a nervous condition when he was examined in the Navy Yard in Boston. And he got out of the draft, and most of his fellow Harvard students did as well. And as they were on the bus leaving the Navy Yard, they saw another bus coming in from Southie, which is the working class area of Boston. He realized those young men would be going to Vietnam, and it haunted him. Jim Webb, in his first and very fine novel called Fields of Fire, made a character out of a man like Jim Fallows. Fallows got in touch with him and said, how dare you? That began a dialogue between the two of them, and now it's a deeply rooted friendship. And that's one of the more positive, I think, positive ends of the 1960s, this relationship between this very thoughtful, long-form journalist Jim Fallows and Jim Webb, who is, whatever else anyone thinks about him, is an interesting and engaged and very bright man who looks at issues very seriously. Jim Webb was a seminal figure in this book. I went back to Vietnam with him. When I was thinking about the book, I knew that he would have a prominent role in it.
Obviously, this is your story as too.
In part, I'm the pilgrim. I'm wandering along the road and sharing my stories as I go. I came out of the 1950s, a working class community in South Dakota, married my college sweetheart. She was 21, I was 22. We went to Omaha, then Atlanta, ended up in Los Angeles in 1966, just as all of this was really beginning to bubble over. So I was not only witness to it as a journalist, but I was kind of living in it all as well. We were having children at the time. We had friends on the left and on the right. So it is my story as well.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our guest, yes, you'll recognize the voice. It's Tom Brokaw. His new book is called Boom, the Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's start with Rick. Rick calling us from Placerville in California.
Hi.
I'm
a political junkie. And was involved, I'm originally from North Dakota, but live in California, and I was very much an opponent of the Vietnam War, but I got drafted and wound up spending 1968 in Vietnam from the weekend of the Tet Offensive till right after the election. And I knew, I had met Bob Kennedy while working for former Governor Brown.
Pat Brown in California?
And I think I met Tom in a bar in L.A. at some convention.
That's very possible.
And then I came back from Vietnam, even though I'd been getting mail from North Vietnam while I was there, and went to the 72 convention. And I would have been on the streets or in the hall in 68 in Chicago had I been able to go on vacation from Vietnam. So I very much parallel some of the things that Tom has talked about.
And what do you think the consequential effect has been? You had to go because you were drafted.
One of the effects was I came back on campus And people would say to me, and I'm opposing the war, how do you know, have you been there? And I'd say, yes. And the conversation changed tremendously. I see now with my Vietnam veteran colleagues or brothers that we are now more willing to talk about it than we were for many, many, many years.
I think that the most interesting part of this book for me are the conversations that I have with Vietnam veterans. They are the most fully resolved people in the book. They saw such trauma at an early age. Many of them were very bitter about how the war was being conducted. Others of them agreed with the larger objectives of it, came back to a hostile country in many instances in which they were told not to wear their military uniforms in San Francisco, bumped up against people who said, how could you have gone? And then many of them ended up in public service and matured at an early age. They don't all have a common view by any means, but they know what it's like to be a public citizen in every sense of the word, and to have worn the uniform and to have gone through that knothole called combat or have been in a war theater. So for me, that was, I suppose, the biggest surprise of the book, was that how collectively interesting the Vietnam veterans are in terms of coming to grips with that time and trying to find a way to move forward together.
And my life since then has been public service, and I find a brotherhood with my fellow veterans no matter what side we were on.
You know, one of the interesting things for me is Gary Trudeau, who began his strip, Doonesbury, really with a very strong anti-war theme attached to it. Now, no one has got the zeitgeist, I believe, of the Iraqis who are veterans who are coming home or those who are still serving better than Gary does in that strip. And he's in the book, and he says, I can't believe that I'm the same person who, you know, was watching from my room window at Yale as the campus was cordoned off by National Guardsmen because of anti-war demonstrations. Now I'm going to Vietnam veterans reunions in Arizona, and I'm getting standing ovations.
Rick, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
If you have questions for Tom Brokaw about 1968, about what happened to you and what happened to the country that year, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Congressman John Lewis, Jeff Greenfield, Sam Brown, Les Gelb, Jeffrey House, Nora Ephron, Gloria Steinem, Judy Collins, just a few of the people that Tom Brokaw speaks to in a new book called Voices of the 60s. Actually, it's called Boom, Voices of the 60s. Tom Brokaw is our guest here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And you write that what you've done here is, in a way, form a sort of virtual town meeting to...
Well, I call it a virtual reunion of the people who went through that time. Well, I've always been interested in the reunion construct and sociology, anthropology, whichever word you want to choose. We go through a common experience together. We go away for a long time. We come back. How has it changed us? What do we think now? Who did we not like then that we maybe feel a little better about now? Who can't we stand now that we really didn't like then? And so in the reunion, I say there are some people here that are unexpected. Some, not everyone showed up. And some of the people who showed up you may not be happy about. But I think it's a pretty representative voice, if you will, of the 1960s.
Let's get another caller on the line. That Jeffrey. Jeffrey with us from Chattanooga.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
We love your show, and thank you for letting me get on.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Reason I'm calling, back as a sixth grader in Des Moines, Iowa, during the 60s, I was the sixth grader. My dad took me, my brother and myself, to a civil rights march from Drake University to the Capitol building at Iowa, which is about a two-mile march. Whites, blacks, students, middle-aged, elderly folks were all involved. But we were cursed at, spit upon, et cetera. So for all my bleeding heart, liberal, rebellious preacher's kid life, I felt like I had a true understanding of the black experience because I had been somewhat involved in that. As an adult, later on, I went to teach at an HBCU, historically black university, Prairie View A&M, just north of Houston. And much to my surprise, I discovered I didn't have a clue because I'm Caucasian.
Right.
Yes, I'm a preacher's kid, so I know what it feels like to have people have expectations and all. But the classes I teach at college now, one of the things I explain to students is, as a preacher's kid, nobody has expectations of me until I acknowledge that. Whereas an African-American, it's obvious what that situation is.
An African-American is an African-American the moment they walk into a room, and people bring all kinds of baggage to that too often.
We had a competitive speech team, and I was often the only white person in the van when we would travel, and we would go into stores. Employees would follow me around because I was with the group of blacks, and it really helped me to understand, boy, when they turn their backs, you really do want to steal something. It was it was really very enlightening to me because I thought I really had a clue, and I didn't.
Well, I think that that's very useful. I write a lot about race in this book and about the civil rights movement and about the bravery of the young people that I saw on the streets of small towns when there was this unbridled violence that was unleashed against them by the Southern law enforcement establishment. It's pretty hard to imagine now, but just 40 years ago, we had institutionalized racism in America. It was legal in the South in many ways. It was de facto in the North. Des Moines was a perfect example of that. I lived in Omaha. There was a real racial separation going on in that city, which had a very significant black population.
Interesting point in your book where you say, at the time, the place where you worked, everybody was running stories about racial segregation in the South and never thought to put the attention, the spotlight, on Omaha.
No, and I had a black friend who worked for the city. He was director of Parks and Recreation. His name was Welcome Bryant. I went out to find out from him about the black community, and he said, "You won't be happy in my neighborhood, and I won't be comfortable in yours. Let's just ride around," which we did one night. And he told me about the black community, and he said, "We just wonder why you're not doing anything here in terms of covering the obvious shortcomings that we're all experiencing." The Omaha World Herald was not doing anything either, but we were giving a good deal of space to what Dr. King was doing. When I got to the South in Atlanta in 1965, it was known as the city too busy to hate. The most enlightened television station in town was the one I worked for. It was the big affiliate for NBC, and it was doing feeds to Huntley Brinkley almost every night. And we had no black employees there on the air except in a custodial or very lower level clerical, if even that.
Thanks very much for the call, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
So long. Let's go now to, this is Bill. Bill with us from Cleveland Heights in Ohio.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
In 1969, I received a deferment as a conscientious objector. And in retrospect, I'm quite ashamed to say that I was one of those people who demonized the men and women who did go to Vietnam. And then after the Vietnam Memorial was built, I felt a pull to that monument that I could not explain. And finally, about 5 years ago, my wife and I visited the memorial, and I simply could not stop crying. I suddenly came to realize that I had far more in common with the people who chose to go, and we weren't really that different after all. We took a stand on what we believed in, and we acted on that. And I have come to have an awfully deep regard and respect, if not a love for the men and women who went despite the enormous differences we had 30 or so years ago.
That's not an uncommon reaction, I'm happy to say. There has been a kind of joining of the generation, if you will, a bonding at this stage in their lives because they're facing so many of the same problems and asking each other the same questions. I was just with a young man the other day. I guess he's not so young anymore. He was a medic in Vietnam. He went because he was a CO as well. But he said, "I'll serve as a medic." And I got to know him in Northwest Connecticut where he ran a small Riverside cafe. And I only knew about his corny jokes and I always thought, blue ribbon French toast that he prepared on Sunday mornings. It turned out he'd had a hellacious time in Vietnam and kept it to himself. And now he's a a member of a community up there where he doesn't wear his Vietnam experience on his sleeve, but everyone is keenly aware of it, and it's drawn everyone together, I suppose. I have friends who went and friends who didn't go. Many of them are in touch with each other, and out of that, as I said earlier, comes this dialogue that I think is some of the most important in the book.
You also dedicate this book to a friend of yours, Gene Kimmel.
I do. Gene Kimmel was a friend of mine at the University of South Dakota. He'd gone in the 101st Airborne right out of high school to get money to go to college, banged up his knee, came to the University of South Dakota. We were all in a kind of a legendary political science department out there in the Great Plains, and he was a very bright student, a Steve McQueen-like character, raced sports cars on weekends when he couldn't afford to, great shot. And during the hunting season, got his master's in political science. He was the editor of the school newspaper when I was a columnist, and then called and said, you know a Marine recruiter who will overlook my banged up knee because I really want to fly Marine jets. I did a tour in combat flying in Vietnam, burned up in a fuel line, went back a second time flying a gunship called the OB-10. It was a brand new aircraft, and they were picking the best pilots out of each service, and tragically, he was shot down and killed, and I went back to his gravesite recently and looked at it and remembered the day that we buried him, and I thought about the life I've had that he didn't get to have and how cruel and unfair that was. But he was very proud of his service, and his family had a hard time dealing with the loss, but they were proud of him as well.
Bill, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to, this is Michael. Michael with us from Conway in, is that Arkansas?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead, please.
You know, I was just thinking, I listen to this program all the time, and I'm grateful to be able to talk to Mr. Brokaw right now. Back in 67, 68, I was freshman, sophomore in high school. I had no opinions about anything. You know, I didn't know anything from anybody. But we protested the war. I can remember my sophomore year, 68, just because I think I got caught up in the crowd. And then in 1972, I joined the Air Force and was stationed in Guam during that linebacker 2 deal. So,
where a lot of B-52s from Guam were bombing North Vietnam, yes.
Yeah, we're bombing North Vietnam, Laos. And still, as a young man, I really had no opinions. It was just more or less follow the crowd, you know. Have you experienced that, Mr. Brokaw, with a lot of Vietnam veterans?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of them were not sure about why they got involved when they signed up or got drafted or volunteered. They weren't even paying particular attention to what was going on politically. It was Dick Cheney, I think, who said to me that there were 3 million who were Vietnam draft age, 3 million who went out of 13 million who were of age. He was saying that in part to defend his own series of deferments. He'd gotten his first deferment when he was a young man in Wyoming, and the draft call was very low because in Wyoming everybody was volunteering to go. They didn't need to fill their quota. And then later he was married and had children. He was in graduate school. It was his fifth deferment by then. But he was making the point that there was a very large pool of people in that age group, and about 3 million of them stepped forward. And many of them were not going off in a John Wayne-like fashion. They were going because they'd been called or they thought it'd be an interesting way to spend some of their lives. It was a deeply, deeply divisive time. And that business about doing it because everyone else was doing it, there was a whole lot of that on college campuses across the country as well. I'm always a little amused by somebody who will say, I spent 24 hours on the barricades at Columbia. Well, what are you doing now? Well, I'm a hedge fund manager. And what have you done since then? Well, I haven't really done as much as I ought to have. Well, what did you change? Well, you know, before I went out there, girls had hours at camp. Well, was that what it was all about? To eliminate the idea of curfews?
Michael, thanks very much for the call. And let's turn now to Lorraine. Lorraine's with us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi, Lorraine. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just think it's interesting that, Tom, great to hear you today, and we've read your book and your past books, but my father was your playmate in Yankton, South Dakota, Ken Dregsa. And I have to say that as you are raised in a family that has been affected by that, conservative background, of course, and then a veteran and a physician still practicing at 83, I think as we raise our generation after generation from the 60s to now, those children, as they're raised by families that promote honor for service to your country and promote honor for service, I think you've done an exemplary job in your publications and your life and all of those things, but I think it's happening each year, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and even today. I have a high school boy going to Africa to serve there when he could be going, you know, to Stanford. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I also know that out of that experience of growing up where I grew up, where people did go off to war and they had strong feelings about it as well, and some of them did resist, but there was a tolerance for other points of view. I always
exactly.
said the most important thing we did with our own girls raising, they were raised mostly in New York City, but every summer they went back to South Dakota, spent time with their grandparents and, you know, and lived in the small town neighborhoods and saw how life was lived out there in the Great Plains. It was very useful to them. The other point that I'd make about parenting, by the way, is that it's kind of amusing to me, and it came to me in writing this book, that the baby boomers pushed back so hard against everything that their parents stood for. Parental authority,
yes.
The construct of marriage, the values of the time, and then when they got to be parents.
Exactly.
They were the most overwrought parents in the history of mankind, hovering over their children like helicopters.
Well, I think that when I say that you guys growing up there and, you know, Ken Dragseth growing up there and then serving me as a child, and now my children are now growing, even though I was just the last generation of the baby boomers being born, I think that we just have to really remember that we can honor those people that serve our country, whether we're doing it or not, but honor them, but teach our children to be honorable and honor those veterans and those people that are serving, and to make it a point to have lives that are meant for others, you know, that are serving for others in that education, politically and socially and emotionally and religiously, all of those things. And I think that we just don't do it enough. You know, America's still
good
repeating
point.
The same things year after year, and it's because at home we're not doing it enough.
Good point. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call, Lorraine. We're talking with Tom Brokaw about his new book, Boom, Voices of the 60s. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And the book concludes with a chapter about an episode that happened very late in that year of 1968, when the crew of Apollo 8, Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders, beamed this message back to Earth as they were the first men to orbit the moon.
And God called the dry land Earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
That, of course, the famous broadcast on Christmas Eve, 1968, and Jim Lovell telling you how many times people have told him over the year, you saved the year.
It really was the punctuation mark for that year, in part because of what has now become, I think, maybe the iconic image to emerge from 1968, which is the picture of this precious planet taken from the moon. First time we'd seen that.
The whole Earth.
Out there in a black void with the filigree of white clouds and deep blue of the oceans, the salmon pinks and the rust browns of the deserts. The deep greens of the wilderness area, the ice caps at either end of the pole. And Lovell, I spoke for all of us when he said, that's our spaceship for 6 or 7 billion of us, and we better figure out how we can all get along on it. And I think most people have that reaction. When they looked at it, they thought, this is such a unique place, and it really does require the best efforts of all of us to get together. Stuart Brand, who was one of the hippie philosophers and intellectuals of the time, published the Whole Earth Catalog, and he put that image on the front and on the back, and beneath it he had a simple caption, "We can't put it together, it is together." The phrase in those days was, "We'll get it together," but he said, "We can't put it together, it is together." And when I asked him recently about that, he said it's what connects, not what divides, that counts. So I think that is an enduring lesson from the 60s.
Yet that moment, everyone was listening and watching as that was read.
A billion people. And now, some people, Jeff Greenfield said, we were talking about it the other night, he said, I get it more now. He said, at that time, I couldn't have cared less about a space shot because Bobby Kennedy was his friend. He was writing speeches for him. We'd been through so much. But it has an enduring effect on the country. And when they look back on it, it was, for me at least, the perfect climactic event to that tumultuous year. We escaped the pull of Earth, went to the moon, and looked back.
We're going to continue talking with Tom Brokaw about his new book, Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We also hope to talk with Seamus Heaney, who's translated Beowulf, number one picture at the movies this weekend. Go figure. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about a much more recent era, the 1960s, a period Tom Brokaw tackles in his new book, Boom, Voices of the 60s. Here's an email we got from David in Denver, Colorado. I can think of some enduring changes brought about by the turmoil of the 60s. I can now go to the grocery store and buy fresh pesticide and hormone additive free food or peanut butter made only of peanuts. My city, Denver, Colorado, has curbside recycling. Many of the energy issues we now face were first addressed in the 1960s. Race relations have improved greatly. There is generally more freedom of personal expression accepted by the culture. And I think he's probably right on all those points.
All documented in the book. Absolutely true. The sweeping changes really have been, if you're an African American, the difference between your life now and your life then is a quantum leap. I was at Ole Miss over the weekend. This woman came up to me. She's the executive assistant to Fred Smith at FedEx. Mm-hmm. And she introduced me to her daughter, who was in graduate school, getting ready to go to graduate school. And I said, where are you going to go? And she said, well, I'm going to stay here at Ole Miss. And her mother explained, this is just like family to us. And I'm the president of the Alumni Association. She was an African-American woman. I mean, that, and they have a statue of James Meredith on the campus. There have been enormous seismic changes for the better. Women still work to be done in both areas. One of the things that I say about the organic food section, for example, is that the boomers did drive a lot of that. And I point out that the same people that you saw at a rock concert ingesting or inhaling anything that was handed to them, you'll now find in the organic food sections of the Whole Food Market reading the fine print and hovering over their kids to make sure that, God forbid, they not have a Big Mac or an ice cream bar that's got some kind of an artificial ingredient in it.
A couple of minutes ago, we were talking about that picture of the whole Earth and that image that tied so many people together. You also write about, you describe it as a phrase, the personal is political, which begins, in a way, you describe it, the atomization of American society.
It did, and it grew out of, understandably, the feminist movement, because they said the personal is political, and they were talking about their right to make a choice about terminating pregnancy. And then it spread to all the other interest groups, and that helped drive us to the far corners of the room ideologically in this country, in which by my lights at least, people look at the political interest and arena and their own interest through narrow a prism. They identify with one particular subject. It could be gun control or choice or any of the many, many others that are out there. And they say, okay, that's how I'm going to measure the candidate, without looking at other qualifications that he or she may have that they bring to public office.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. And this is going to be Dave. Dave with us from Longmont, is that right, in Colorado?
Yes, uh-huh.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, in 1968, I was a junior in high school. I grew up on a very small farm in northeast Missouri. Literally, we had crank telephones and an outhouse. But and I was glued to the tube, as Walter Cronkite described the circling of the moon.
Cronkite worked for one of those other networks, but go ahead.
That's all right.
Yes, well, sorry about that. But but I dedicated my life and my career to exploration of space. I ultimately achieved a PhD in engineering, went into the aerospace industry. I recently retired as an executive. And last night, it's amazing, I was playing 2001 Space Odyssey for a friend of mine who was 3 years old at the time. And she had never seen the movie, and I started crying. And she said, What is wrong? And I said, we could have achieved all of this. We could have done everything here. And she said, well, why didn't we? And I said, we lost the vision. And I said, unfortunately, I think I will die before we ever get it back.
I think there's something to that. Space exploration now is not even being talked about in this presidential campaign about what our priorities ought to be and what the budget ought to be. There is a vast unknown universe out there. I have come around to believe that we ought to be shifting our priorities to unmanned space exploration on a scientific basis. I think a lot of people are still struggling with what the real value of the space platform is. So they've taken their eye off that ball. NASA is a beleaguered agency at this time. We did get launched in a very promising way. There are lots of questions to be answered, and we're not even asking them anymore. It was a very exciting part of that time. You know, I don't even write about landing on the moon. It's just the circumnavigation of the moon.
Interesting, you talked about the people who saw themselves as revolutionaries. Well, the revolutionaries, the true revolutionaries, the people who really did change the world, were wearing pencil pocket protectors and called themselves geeks.
And they were, and in fact, they were already hacking computers, but they were large-scale computers on college campuses and in big corporations. And Stuart Brand reminds me that one of the most exciting developments that he was witness to was the first demonstration of a little device called the mouse.
In 1968.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I was one of the people walking around with a 6-inch slide rule in my pocket. and I just met with some NASA officials about a month ago. And right now, NASA does have a program to get man back on the moon. But it'll be 2020 at best.
Yep.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank our guest, Tom Brokaw. His new book is called Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. He joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much. Good luck with it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Neil. I've enjoyed it a lot.
When we come back, talking about Beowulf, the translation.